If the police can't find the girl's family, I'll have her buried properly myself. And then the restoration project will continue. You can't! The words were out before Fiona could stop them. They came from somewhere deep inside her, from a well of something she almost never acknowledged. Grief, anger, outrage. Get a grip, Fiona, she thought. But instead, she said, No girl is going to want to go to school in that place. And yet, girls did, Margaret said, unfazed by Fiona's outburst. For 60 years. She looked Fiona over again, but this time her expression was softer. Tell me something. Her voice lowered, became more intimate. At Idlewild, did you see her? Fiona's skin went cold. The girl in the black dress and veil standing in the field. But no, that wasn't possible. See who? Mary Hand, Margaret replied. Fiona had never heard the name before, but something about it made her stomach drop, made her brain do a lazy spin. I don't... She cleared her throat. I don't know who that is. But Margaret was watching her face, missing nothing. Yes, you do, she said. You've seen her. This morning, I think. Anthony said you were standing in the field. Fiona blinked at her in horror. Is that what this is? She asked. Is that what this whole thing is all about? You're some kind of ghost hunter? She was wearing a black dress, wasn't she? Margaret said. She had a veil over her face. Did she speak to you? Their gazes were locked, and Fiona couldn't look away. From nowhere, she recalled the words etched into the glass of the classroom window. Good night, girl. Who is she? She asked. Who is Mary Hand? She's a legend, Margaret replied. I don't know if she existed or who she was. I've spent money looking. I can't find a record of her. I don't know if she was ever real. A student? Who knows? Margaret shrugged and leaned back again, breaking the connection. What I'd like more than anything is the Idlewild file so I can see for myself, but they weren't on the property when we bought it. Anthony says they're gone. Fiona held still. She didn't think about Sarah London or Kathy telling her aunt's secret that the files were sitting in her shed. Do you think that will answer your questions? She asked Margaret. You think that this ghost, Mary Hand, is in the files somewhere? But Margaret only smiled. I think they'd be illuminating, she said. Don't you?
Chapter 16. Barrons, Vermont, November 2014. Jamie insisted on coming with her to pick up the files from Sarah London's back shed. It was a Thursday, his day off shift, because as the police department's junior member, Jamie was 29, but the force was hardly swamped with new recruits. He worked all the weekend shifts. Like a man born from a line of true cops, he ignored Fiona's suggestion he take an actual day off and drove her to East Mills to clean out the ancient shed filled with papers that had been sitting there for 35 years. Fiona gave in, unable to resist not only Jamie, but the use of his strong shoulders in hauling boxes and his much bigger SUV. So they drove down the rutted, two-lane blacktop off the highway as the sun climbed, slanting thin, late-autumn light into their eyes even though it was after 9 o'clock. The days were getting shorter, and soon they'd be in the dregs of winter, when the sun never warmed the air no matter how bright, and the light was gone by 5. They talked as they drove, Jamie in jeans and a thick flannel shirt over a T-shirt, his hair combed back, a Dunkin' Donuts coffee in one hand as he drove with the other. Fiona wore a pullover sweater and jeans, her hair in a ponytail, and leaned against the passenger door, sipping her own coffee as they talked. It had been a while since they'd spent a day together, 2 weeks, maybe 3. Jamie picked up as much overtime as the force's budget would allow, and Fiona's schedule was equally offbeat as she wrote one story or another. They usually kept their conversations light, but today it wasn't going to happen. She had too much on her mind. Jamie, as always, was a good listener, and before she knew it, the words were spilling out. She told him about her visit to Idlewild. It hadn't been her finest moment, and she still didn't know what to make of what she'd seen on the field. But she forced the story out, trying to keep her voice matter of fact. Jamie didn't chide her about trespassing or not answering his texts, and he took in her account of the ghost with surprised silence. "Jesus Christ, Fiona," he said at last. Fiona gulped her coffee. "Say it," she prompted him. "If you think I should go on meds, just say it." He shook his head. "No meds," he said. "I can't say I know what you saw, but I don't think you're crazy." She stared at him for a long time, waiting for more. But the silence stretched out in the car, the hum of the SUV's engine the only sound between them. "That's it?" she said. "You think I actually saw a ghost?"
"Why not?" he said, surprising her. "You want me to say it isn't possible? How the hell do I know what's possible or not? Kids have always said that place is haunted."
"Have you ever heard the name Mary Hand?" Fiona asked.
"No."
"Margaret Eden has," she said. "She says there's a legend about a girl named Mary Hand haunting the grounds, and yet Margaret also says she was never a student and she isn't local." She paused, looking out the passenger window, unseeing. "She knew what I saw, Jamie. She knew."
"Is there any way she could have been repeating back something you'd already said?"
Fiona thought back over the conversation. "No. Margaret described the black dress and veil. I hadn't talked about that. I hadn't admitted anything."
"A girl with a veil," Jamie said, musing. "I haven't heard that particular story before. Then again, I never did a dare to go on the Idlewild grounds growing up. I was the straight and narrow kid, destined to become a cop. What about you?"
Fiona shook her head. "Deb was into friends and boys, not ghost-hunting dares, which meant I wasn't either." The words cut sharply, the memory still clear. Deb had been 3 years older, and Fiona had followed everything she did. She'd worn Deb's hand-me-down clothes, her old shoes, her old winter jackets. She was quieter and more introverted than her outgoing sister, but she'd tried her best not to be. Deb had been a road map of what to be, and when she'd died, that road map had vanished, leaving Fiona adrift for 20 years and counting. If this... It felt strange to talk about a ghost like it was actually a real thing. If Mary Hand has been there all these years, someone must have seen her besides me. Sarah London told me that everyone at the school lived in fear of something, but she'd never heard of Margaret.
"So Sarah London knows," he said. "Maybe Mary Hand was a student. If so, there should be something about her in the records."
"That's what Margaret thinks." Fiona drained the last of her coffee. "She wants these records. She was a cagey old lady. I can't figure out what her game is, whether it's money or ghosts or something else she wants. But the records are definitely part of what she's looking for. I think she suspected that I know where they are."
"Well, we're one up on her then," Jamie said, grinning. "Let's see what happens when she knows they're yours. Maybe she'll come to you with a different game."
Fiona smiled at him.
"What?"
he said, glancing at her. "You're sucked in," she said. "Just like I am. Admit it."
"Maybe."
"Maybe," she mocked him. He pulled into Sarah London's gravel drive and turned off the ignition. Her heart gave a little pop because she knew that look in his eyes. Still, she watched as he put his cup down, leaned over, and took her face in his hands. He kissed her slowly, properly, taking his time. She tried to stay unaffected, but he was oh so good at it. She felt the rasp of his beard and the press of his thumbs, and before she knew it, she was gripping his wrists and kissing him back, letting her teeth slide over his bottom lip as he made a sound in her mouth and kissed her harder. Sometimes their kisses were complicated, a kind of conversation on their own, but this one wasn't. This was just Jamie, kissing her in his car as the bright sunlight slanted in, making the moment spin on and on. Finally, they paused for breath.
"Come to dinner at my parents' tonight," he said, still holding her face, his breath on her cheek.
She felt herself stiffen. She'd met Jamie's parents once, briefly, and she was pretty sure a journalist was not whom they wanted for their precious son. "I don't think that's a good idea."
"Sure it is."
He kissed her neck, and she tried not to shiver.
"We've been dating for a year, Fee. Having dinner with the parents is part of the deal."
It was. She knew it was. But a meet-the-parents evening. Jesus, she wasn't ready for this. "I'm no good at it," she warned him. "The girlfriend thing. I'm terrible at it, actually."
"I know," he said, and he laughed softly when he felt her stiffen in offense. "But they've been asking about you. My mother especially. She wants to feed you pot roast and ask leading questions about what your intentions are."
Oh, my God. Fiona didn't even like pot roast. She'd had pretzels for dinner last night.
"I know we've taken it slow, Fee," he said. "I get it. I wanted to take it slow, too. But it's time."
Damn it. He was right. There was only so long she would have gotten away with putting this off.
"Look, I can endure it. But if we do this, they're going to think we're serious."
She regretted the words. This could lead to the "are we serious" conversation, and thought he might argue. But Jamie just exhaled a sigh and leaned against the seat next to her.
"I know," he said, "but I have to give them something. My mother actually asked me when I'm going to find a nice girl and settle down."
Fiona paused, surprised at how that alarmed her. The words bubbled up. "Is that what you want? To get married and settle down?" But she bit them back. What if he said, "Yes, it is"? They were not having this conversation. It had been only a year. That wasn't long. This was 2014. People weren't expected to court and get married anymore like it was 1950. But Jamie was younger than she was, and he hadn't grown up with free-thinking hippie parents. He didn't ask her for much. As much as she hated the idea of dinner with his parents, she could do it. For him. Just suck it up and go. "Fine," she finally said, half-heartedly shoving against his chest. "I'll go, all right? I'll eat pot roast. Now let's get moving. You're going to give that old lady a heart attack if she's looking out the window." He grinned and grabbed his coat from the back seat. Miss London wasn't watching from the window. She didn't come to the door either, even after repeated knocking. Worried, Fiona pulled out her cell phone and walked to the end of the drive, looking for cell reception. She was partway down the street when she lucked into enough bars to call Kathy.
"I had to take Aunt Sari for a checkup," Kathy said. "The doctor changed the time, and she can't miss her checkups. Just go around back to the shed. I left the key under the old gnome."
So they walked around the house to the backyard. Miss London had no neighbors behind her, and her backyard sloped away into a thicket of huge pine trees, stark and black now against the gray sky. Beyond that were a few tangled fields and a power station crisscrossed with metal towers. Crows shouted somewhere overhead, and a truck engine roared from the nearby two-lane highway. Standing behind the old house was a shed covered with vinyl siding in avocado green. Fiona felt for the key beneath the garden gnome on the back porch, while Jamie cleared the shed doorway of the snow shovel and the wheelbarrow leaning against it. The door was rusted, held shut by a padlock that was dulled with age and exposure. Fiona had a moment of doubt that the old lock would even work, but the key slid in easily, and Jamie popped off the lock and swung open the door.
"Oh, hell," he said.
The shed was full, literally full of cardboard file boxes stacked from floor to ceiling, some of them collapsing beneath a quarter century of weight. Fiona's heart sped up. This was it. 60 years of Idlewild's history compacted into one old woman's shed. Somewhere in here was the answer to who Sonia Galipo was, maybe even where she'd come from. Somewhere in here were files about Sonia's friends, who might still be alive. Somewhere in here might even be a file about a girl named Mary Hand. Unable to help herself, she tugged on the first box sitting at eye level and hauled it out, placing it on the cold ground and popping the lid off. Inside were textbooks, old and yellowed. The top was titled Latin Grammar for Girls. Jamie read the title over her shoulder.
"The good old days," he commented, "when apparently Latin was different if you were a girl."
Fiona agreed. She lifted the textbook and found a few others stacked inside. Biology, history. "It looks like Miss London wanted to keep the curriculum as well as all the records." She looked up at him. "Is all of this going to fit in your SUV?" He glanced around, calculating.
"Sure," he said. "The bigger question is, are you going to keep all of this in your apartment?"
"I have room." He shrugged, picked up the box, and carted it toward the car. It took them nearly 90 minutes to empty the shed. Considering how long the boxes had been sitting there, surprisingly few of them had water damage. Even when building sheds with vinyl siding, Yankees had taken pride in their craftsmanship in the 70s. They drove off with all of Idlewild in the back of Jamie's SUV, smelling like damp cardboard. There were 21 boxes in all. Fiona tried to organize them once they had unloaded them into her small apartment, stacked in the living room. Some boxes contained tests and lesson plans. These were shoved against the wall as unimportant. Some contained financial records like paychecks and supplier bills. These were stacked next as possibles. Some seemed to contain random memorabilia, probably scooped from classrooms on the school's last day before closing. A desk-sized globe, a slide rule, a rolled-up poster, the old textbooks. These Fiona set aside as fascinating but not necessary to the story. When she'd finished the article, she'd take pictures of them to add to the context of the story when it went to press. The final 5 boxes were student records. Fiona and Jamie ordered Chinese delivery for lunch and split the last boxes, looking for the names on Fiona's list, as well as any other names that stood out as interesting. Jamie's box contained the G files, and the first folder he pulled out was Sonia Galipo's. The first page listed Sonia's height, weight, age, uniform size, and date of admission to Idlewild. It listed her nearest family member as her great-uncle, Mr. Henry Dubois, of Burlington, a name Jamie recognized from his search for Sonia's relatives. Henry Dubois and his wife, Eleanor, were the people Sonia had visited for the weekend before she was murdered. The last known people who saw her alive. They were both dead and had no children. There was no photograph. Fiona found herself wishing she knew what Sonia had looked like. There are a few pages listing Sonia's grades. All were high. A teacher had written in pencil, bright and quiet, adept at memorization, physical fitness adequate. Sonia's body was small. If she'd been in a concentration camp, she'd have been malnourished while she was supposed to be growing. But she would have had to be strong to survive at all. Fiona made a note to ask a doctor for an opinion. There was a piece of notepaper slipped into the file, signed by Gerda Hedmeyer, the Idlewild school nurse. Student brought to infirmary November 4, 1950. Fainting spell during weekly gardening. No reason known. Student is slight, possibly iron deficient. Complained of headache. Gave student aspirin and instructed her to rest. Released to care of Roberta Green, student's dorm mate.
"There's Roberta," Jamie said as Fiona read over his shoulder. "Proof that they were friends. We need to talk to her."
Fiona stared at the note. Roberta Green, who had brought her friend to the infirmary when she'd fainted 64 years ago, was at the moment the closest thing to family Sonia Gallipo had. It was definitely time to meet Roberta.
"This is interesting," Jamie said, pointing to the nurse's note. "She says it's a possible iron deficiency."
"That's code," Fiona explained.
"What?"
"It means Sonia was having her period on the day she fainted. It was a polite way to refer to it back then. Our old doctor still used that when I was growing up."
"But this is in the nurse's own notes," he protested. "In an all-female boarding school, there wasn't a man for miles around."
"It doesn't matter. It was going in the file, where others could read it. She still had to be polite. It was a generational thing." He shook his head.
"That generation blows my mind. They didn't talk about anything at all. My granddad fought in the war and never talked about it, not even to Dad. An entire damn war, and not one word."
"It's true," Fiona said. "There's nothing in this file about Sonia being in a concentration camp. If she had come from one, the school nurse didn't even know. She would have lived with the experience and never talked about it. All of these girls, these Idlewild girls, whatever they went through to end up sent off to boarding school, they probably never spoke of it. That wasn't how it was done." The next page of the file, the final page, contained the entry about Sonia's disappearance. It was written by Julia Patton, Idlewild's headmistress, neatly typed on a page of letterhead. December 5th, 1950, Idlewild Hall. I, Julia Patton, headmistress of Idlewild Hall, state that on November 28th, 1950, student Sonia Gallipo was given weekend leave to visit relatives. She departed at 11 o'clock on Friday, November 28th, intending to take the 12 o'clock bus to Burlington. She wore a wool coat and skirt and carried a suitcase. She was seen walking up Old Barron's Road to the bus stop by several students. I also state that Sonia Gallipo did not return to Idlewild Hall, neither on the intended day of her return, November 30, 1950, nor any other day. I swear hereby that she has not been seen again by me, by any teacher in my employ, or by any other student in my care. On the morning of December 1, 1950, when I was informed by a member of my staff that Sonia had not returned, I placed a call to the Barron's police and reported her missing. I was interviewed by officers Daniel O'Leary and Garrett Creel and gave a statement. I also helped police search the woods by Old Barron's Road when it was made known to police that Sonia had in fact boarded the bus leaving Burlington on November 29, 1950. We found a suitcase that I recognize as Sonia's, which now resides in my office. It is my belief that Sonia ran away, likely with the aid of someone helping her, possibly a boy. Signed, Julia Patton. A note, handwritten across the bottom of the page, read, "Addendum, December 9, 1950. Suitcase now missing from my office. Not located. J.P. Jamie put the file down and stood up, pacing to the window. He didn't speak. Running a hand through her hair, Fiona turned to Julia Patton's statement and picked it up. She turned the paper over, noting the faint carbon marks on the back. "This was typed with carbon paper behind it," she said. "She probably gave a copy to the police." Though the police would not have received the handwritten addendum, which had been added later.
"It isn't in the missing persons file," Jamie said. "There's only a report from Daniel O'Leary."
"Is that weird?" Fiona asked him. "Pages missing from case files?"
"In a case 64 years old?" "I don't know. Probably not."
He went quiet again. He was possibly thinking about Garrett Creel Sr., his grandfather, who had apparently interviewed Julia Patton about the disappearance alongside his colleague, and what the file implied about him. Fiona let him wrestle with it for a minute.
"It was a different time," Jamie finally said, "but it's pretty clear that no one took Sonia's disappearance seriously."
He paused.
"Not even Granddad."
It was bothering him. Jamie was proud of his cop's lineage. The judgment on Sonia is pretty harsh, Fiona agreed, especially coming from the headmistress. I know she left her relatives, but to conclude that she ran off with a boy? This was a girl who lived under supervision in a boarding school. She was hardly out tearing up barons, seducing boys. And she had no suitcase.
I don't understand it, Jamie said, still looking out the window. How no one could have thought something bad could have happened to her. How it didn't even cross their minds. She was a 15-year-old girl who had dropped her suitcase and disappeared.
Unbidden, Malcolm's words came into Fiona's mind.
Was she a Jew?
There was nothing in the school's file about Sonia being Jewish, but what if she had been? Would the police have searched for a runaway girl who was a Jewish refugee with no family, the same way they would have searched for a local Catholic girl? And who had taken Sonia's suitcase from Julia Patton's office? Her killer had put Sonia's body in the well, which was nearly within view of the headmistress's office window. Had the killer taken the suitcase as well? If the suitcase contained a clue to the killer's identity, it would have to be disposed of. Could Julia Patton have known who Sonia's killer was? Could she have done it herself? She read the headmistress's note again. The fact that she left her great aunt and uncles a day early bothers me. She'd gone all that way to visit them. Why did she turn around and leave?
We may never know.
Fiona put the file down. Let's continue, she said. We can't answer these questions now. Let's find the other girls' files.
We don't have time, Jamie said, turning from the window and checking his watch. We're due for dinner at my parents'.
No, no, you've got to be kidding me. Jamie shook his head.
You promised, so you're coming. These files will be here when we get back.
I can't leave. She felt physical pain, staring at the boxes she wanted so badly to open.
Yes, you can.
She got up reluctantly from her spot on the floor and brushed off the legs of her jeans. Fine, but I'm not dressing up, and we're coming back here.
After dinner, Jamie said. I promise.
They were in Jamie's car, and he was pulling on to Meredith Street when Fiona's phone rang. It was her father.
I've got something, he said when she answered. About your Sonia girl.
Fiona felt her mouth go dry. What is it?
I had a professor friend of mine put me in touch with a student to do some archival research, he said. She found her in a passenger manifest on a ship leaving Calais in 1947, Sonia Gallipo, age 12, traveling alone. Same date of birth as your girl.
That's her, Fiona said.
The manifest lists her previous place of residence, Malcolm said. An official took the information down, but it must have come from her.
Fiona closed her eyes to the blacktop flying by, to the stark trees and the gray sky, to everything. Tell me, she said.
I'm sorry, sweetheart, her father said. Her previous place of residence was Ravensbrook Prison.
Chapter 17. Roberta. Barrons, Vermont, November 1950. Of all the hated classes at Idlewild, and that was most of them, weekly gardening was the most despised. It had come, Roberta supposed, from some misguided idea that the housewives of the future should know how to grow their own vegetables. Or perhaps it descended from an idea that the school would subsist on its own produce, like a nunnery. In any case, every girl who attended Idlewild had to spend an hour every week in the communal school garden, digging hopelessly in the dirt and trying not to get her uniform muddy as she poked at the dead vegetables. The month had slid into November, cold and hard. Roberta stood in a row with four other girls as Mrs. Peabody handed them each a gardening tool.
We are going to add lettuces to our planting next spring, so today we'll be digging space before the ground freezes.
She indicated a chalked-off square of ground filled with dead weeds and rocks.
1 hour, girls. Get started.
Roberta looked at Sonia, who was standing next to her. Sonia was huddled into her old wool coat,
her face pinched and miserable, her thin hands on the handle of her shovel.
Are you all right?
Bon. Sonia wiped her nose with the back of her hand. She reverted to French when she was tired. Roberta buttoned her own coat higher over her neck and bent to her work. It wasn't the work that the girls loathed. It was the garden itself. It was placed in the crux of shadows between the main hall and the dining hall, and it was relentlessly cold, damp, and moldy, no matter the season. The windows of both buildings stared blankly down at the girls as they worked. There was a persistent legend at Idlewild that Mary Hand's baby was buried in the garden, which did nothing to add to the attraction of weekly gardening. Every time Roberta gardened in here, she expected to find baby bones. The girls bent to work, their breath puffing in the morning air, the slanting November sunshine on the common putting them all in dark shadow. Roberta felt her shoes squish. The garden was always wet, with runnels of water pooling in the overturned dirt. Mary Van Wharton raised her head and stared at Sonia.
"You are not digging,"
she said, her mouth pursing in her pale, round face.
"I am digging,"
Fiona said grimly, pushing her shovel into the dirt.
"No, you're not. You have to dig harder, like the rest of us."
"Leave her alone," Roberta said. She watched Sonia from the corner of her eye. The girl was gripping her shovel, wedging it into the wet dirt, but she wasn't lifting much. Her teeth were chattering. Sonia was small, but she was strong, and this wasn't like her.
"Sonia?" Roberta said softly.
"I am fine."
As if to illustrate this, Sonia pushed at her shovel again.
"You aren't even making a hole,"
Mary persisted. Sonia lifted her face and snapped at her.
"You stupid girl,"
she bit out, her hands shaking.
"You've never had to dig. You've never had to dig."
"What does that mean?" Mary said. "I'm digging right now."
"I think there's something wrong with her," Margaret Kevin piped up. "Mary, be quiet." "Shut up,"
Sonia shouted, stunning all of them. Roberta had never seen her friend so angry.
"Just be quiet, all of you, and leave me alone."
They dug in silence. Roberta glanced back over her shoulder and saw Mrs. Peabody smoking a cigarette near the door to the teacher's hall, talking quietly with Mrs. Wentworth. They laughed at something, and Mrs. Wentworth shook her head. From the girl's place in the shadows, the two teachers looked bathed in sunlight, as if Roberta were watching them through a magical doorway. She looked down at the space she was digging, the mottled, ugly clots of dirt. Baby bones. She always thought of baby bones here. Finger bones, leg bones, a soft little skull.
"Don't think about it. Don't."
The blade of her shovel slipped, and for a second there was something white and fleshy speared on the metal, something pale and soft and rotten. Roberta flinched and dropped the shovel, preparing to scream, before she realized what she'd severed was a mushroom, huge and wet in the cold, damp earth. She was trying to calm down when there was a huff of breath next to her, like a sigh. She turned to see Sonia fall to her knees in the dirt. She still clutched her shovel, her hand sliding down the handle as she lowered to the ground. Roberta bent and grabbed her friend by the shoulders.
"I can do it," Sonia said, her head bowing so her forehead nearly touched the ground, her eyes rolling back in her head. "Mrs. Peabody!"
Mary Van Wharton shouted.
"Sonia,"
Roberta whispered, clutching the girl harder. Sonia's shoulders heaved, and she quietly threw up drops of spit into the dirt. Then she sagged, her eyes closing. Roberta held her tight. Her friend weighed almost nothing at all.
"Have you been sleeping?" Miss Hedmeyer, the school nurse, said. "Eating?"
"Yes, madame."
Sonia's voice was pale, tired. Miss Hedmeyer jabbed her fingers up under Sonia's jaw, feeling her lymph nodes. "No swelling," she said. No fever. What else?
I have a headache, madame.
Roberta bit the side of her thumb as she watched Miss Hedmeyer take a bottle of aspirin out of a cupboard and shake out a few large, chalky pills.
I've seen this before, Miss Hedmeyer said.
She had light blonde hair that contrasted with a startling spray of freckles across her nose. When she wasn't treating the ailments of the Idlewild girls, she taught their meager science curriculum, which mostly consisted of the periodic table of elements and the process of photosynthesis, sometimes mixed with explanations of snow and rain. It was not assumed that the housewives of the future needed to know much about science. It happens to some girls when they're asked to do physical activity during their time of month. Am I correct? Sonia blinked and said nothing, and even Roberta could see her abject humiliation.
Get some rest, Miss Hedmeyer said.
She tapped Sonia on the arm of her thick uniform sweater.
You need to be tougher, she advised. Girls like you. There's not a thing wrong with you. We feed you good food here.
Sonia's voice was nearly a whisper.
Yes, madame.
And less French, please. This is America. The nurse turned to Roberta. I'll talk to Mrs. Peabody and get you the next hour free to make sure she doesn't faint again. Since you're on the field hockey team, she'll likely agree. Roberta kept her eyes downcast.
Thank you, Miss Hedmeyer.
She took Sonia's hand as they left the room. She thought vaguely of putting the girl's arm around her shoulder and half carrying her to their room. But Sonia stayed upright, even climbing the dorm stairs, though she kept her cold, clammy hand in Roberta's, her gaze down on her feet. In their room, Roberta helped her take off her mud-soaked stockings and shoes. They worked in silence, Roberta hanging the stockings over the doorknob to dry. Dried mud was easier to get out in the sink than the wet kind, as Sonia pulled back her covers and lay in bed, still wearing her skirt and sweater. Sonia folded her hands over her chest. Roberta kicked her own shoes off and sat on the edge of the bed, looking down at her friend's pale face.
Tell me, she said.
Sonia stared at the wooden slats that made up Roberta's bunk above hers.
It is a sad story, she said.
We all have sad stories, Roberta countered, thinking of Uncle Van. Without thinking, she added, please. The words seemed to surprise Sonia, who glanced at Roberta, then away again. Dutifully, she spoke.
My mother distributed pamphlets during the war, she said, for the resistance. She helped smuggle the pamphlets from the printers to the places they needed to go. I helped her.
Roberta bit the side of her thumb again.
In France? She wondered. What sorts of pamphlets?
Resistance against Hitler? Already she was lost. She knew so little. No one talked to girls their age about the war. Some girls had brothers and cousins who went away, and either got killed or came back again, like Uncle Van. No one had ever taught any of them about a resistance. But she wanted Sonia to keep talking, so she nodded, silent.
We knew it was dangerous, Sonia said. Papa was already gone to Dachau. He was a writer. He was outspoken. They took him early, but they left us because Mama's father had once worked for the government. But they arrested us in early 1944. I was 9.
Roberta breathed as quietly as she could, listening.
We were sent to prison first, Sonia said. It wasn't so bad. Mama tried to get us kept there because of her father. But her father was dead by then, and they put us on the train. We went to Ravensbrück.
What is Ravensbrück? Roberta finally said, unable to help herself.
It was a prison camp.
Like Auschwitz? That was a name she knew. There had been a newsreel at the cinema once, before the movie started, that showed the gates in black and white, the train tracks, something about liberation. That had been in the last days before Uncle Van came home.
Yes, but only for women, Sonia said. And children.
Roberta blinked, shocked. Sonia didn't seem to notice.
We were put in a barracks, she said, Mama and me. We were made to work. There was a work detail that dug all day. There was never an end to the digging. We weren't even making anything, just moving dirt back and forth. Still, they made us do it. In the heat, in the cold, without food or water, whoever fell during work detail was left there to rot. Women fell every day.
Roberta felt her heart rise up and start beating in her neck, squeezing it in dread. I'm not ready to hear this. I'm not.
We stood every day in the Appelplatz, Sonia said. That was the main square in the camp. They lined us up and made us stand for hours and hours. It was supposed to be a roll call, but of course it wasn't. We froze or we sweated under the sun. Whoever fell was left. Mama was all right at first, but as the days went by, she got quiet. Quiet, quiet. I thought it was a good thing because when you were quiet, you got by and no one noticed you. Then one day, as they made us stand in the Appelplatz, she started to scream.
Sonia twisted the edge of her bedsheet softly between her fingers, dropping her gaze to it.
She screamed and screamed. She said they were murderers. They would all go to hell. She said the war would be over one day, and it would all come out. She said there would be justice, that there would be no silence in the end. She said that the murderers would someday see, that they would someday face their maker. They took her away, and I never saw her again. I heard one of the women say they executed her. They shot her in the back of the head, but I didn't know if it was true. If she'd just stayed quiet, she dropped the sheet. If she'd just stayed quiet, but she did not. And then it was just me.
Could you get away? Roberta whispered. Sonia turned her head and looked at her.
When we arrived, they told us that if we wanted, we could see the last woman who tried to climb the fence, because she was still there.
She turned back to looking at the wooden slats again.
She was.
Roberta could not speak.
Today, it was like I was back there, Sonia said. It doesn't happen often. The war ended, and they brought us all out of there, and I came here. I'm fed and taken care of. I don't think about it. But today, it was like weekly gardening had never existed. I was 10 again, on work detail. It's hard to explain. It was more real to me than you are right now.
Roberta put her head in her hands. Her temples were throbbing, and she wished now she'd gotten her own chalky white aspirin pill from Miss Hedmeyer. Her eyes were hot, and she wanted to cry, but the tears were jammed in her throat, hard and painful. Had Uncle Van seen these things? Was that why he tried to use his gun in the garage? She made herself take a breath. And the other day, in the dining hall?
That was...
Sonia searched in her mind, tried to find the words.
We had Blakovas, she said. Black leaders. They were prisoners who were promoted, assigned to oversee other prisoners.
Women? Roberta asked. Shocked again?
Yes. A few were nice and tried to sneak us things, but most were not. They wanted favor. They had leave to beat you, report on you. If you misbehaved, you were sent to the punishment block, solitary confinement, and worse.
Roberta thought back to that day in the dining hall, Allison punching Sherry, Sherry's nose bleeding, the chaos and the noise, Lady Loon shouting, "It's special detention for you, my girl. Do you hear? Get moving. Move." It made sense now. A horrible, nightmarish kind of sense. She circled back to the main problem. "What are you going to do?" she asked the other girl. "This can't keep happening. You'll get sent to special detention." Katie, the strongest and boldest of them, had been sent to special detention, and she'd been so shaken she refused to talk about it. Roberta wasn't sure Sonia would survive it. "You could be expelled," she said. "You have nowhere to go."
Sonia's chin went hard, her eyes clouded. It won't happen again.
Roberta wasn't sure about that. But as Sonia drifted to sleep, she sat still, her mind dwelling on the problem, poking at it from all sides. Sonia was tired, drained. But Roberta was resilient. So was Cece. So was Katie. They'd gotten this far, all of them, without breaking, without dying. Sonia wasn't alone. Together they could do something. Together they could carry on. They sat on the floor of their room that night, all four of them, gathered around Cece's radio. With the sound low so Susan Brady wouldn't hear, they listened to a show about cops chasing a murderer and a rendition of Three Little Maids that made them all laugh. Then another show, this one about cowboys, before it got late enough that everything went off the air and Cece turned the radio off. And then they talked. In the dark, when they'd all been listening for hours, already relaxed, it suddenly became easy. The words flowed, weaving over one another, making up the pattern as they went along. Roberta told about Uncle Van, about the day she had opened the garage door and found him, sitting on a wooden chair, weeping, a pistol in his mouth. She told them of the days afterward, the silence in herself that she couldn't break, the doctors, Uncle Van's bloodshot eyes. He hadn't been able to look at her. Roberta felt a new lump in her throat as she told it, remembering. She wished now that she'd crawled into Uncle Van's lap and put her arms around his neck and never let go. But she'd been 13, and everyone had been horrified and silent, including her, and she hadn't known what to do. "Where is he now?" Katie's low voice came through the dark when Roberta finished. "He's still at home," Roberta said. "He sees doctors. Mother says he isn't well, that Dad wants to put him in a hospital." She forced the words out. "They're fighting, Mother and Dad. I could see it on family visit day. They wouldn't look at each other, talk to each other. They're ashamed of me and Uncle Van both. I know Dad works a lot." Mother's eyes were red, and she says it isn't a good time to come home. The others talked now, as Roberta subsided. A weight had lifted from her chest. Each girl spoke while the others were quiet, listening. It went like that, night after night. Katie, with Cece as an accomplice, began pilfering extra food from the dining hall at supper, sneaking through a door into the kitchen and taking it while Cece kept watch. They snacked on the extra food every night after dark. They pretended that it was for all of them, but by tacit agreement they gave most of it to Sonia. With the lights out and the cold winter coming outside, they ate and listened to the radio and told their stories, one by one, detail upon detail. Katie and Thomas, the boy who'd attacked her and told her to hold still. Cece and her mother's accident at the beach. Roberta told them, hesitantly, about the song she'd heard on the hockey field, the same song Uncle Van had been playing in the garage that day, as if someone or something had drawn the memory straight from her mind. And the next night, Katie told them about special detention, and the spiders, and the messages in the textbooks, and the scratching at the window, the voice begging to be let in. Sonia spoke rarely, but when she did, the others went silent, listening from the first word. She told them slowly, doling out, piece by piece, about Ravensbrook, the layout of the barracks and the other buildings, the women and the other children she'd met there, the weather, the cold, the food, the day-to-day comings and goings of the prison, the stories the women had told. It was slow, and it was hard to hear, but the girls listened to all of it. And as Sonia spoke, Roberta fancied that perhaps she felt better. That sending the experience out of her head and into words made it less immense, less impossible. They set up a signaling system for her to use if she felt another episode coming on, but Sonia didn't use it. They were trapped here at Idlewild. But Idlewild wasn't everything. It wasn't the world. "Someday, by God," Roberta thought, "I'm going to get out of here. Someday we all will. And when we do, we will finally be free." Chapter 18. Barrons, Vermont, November 2014. Jamie's parents lived in a bungalow that had been built in the 1960s, covered with vinyl siding in the 1970s, and never touched since. It sat on a stretch of road heading out of downtown Barrons, where the houses had been built close together with neat square yards crowned by wooden porches. Jamie's father, Garrett Creel Jr., opened the door as they climbed the front steps. He was still massive at 60, broad-shouldered and tall, his ruddy face emphasized by his short-cropped sandy hair. He could have worn a sign around his neck that said, "I am a retired policeman," and no one would have batted an eye. He clapped his son on the shoulder and gave Fiona a kiss on the cheek. His lips were dry and chapped, his hand clammy, and Fiona gritted her teeth and smiled as she greeted him. The house wafted with the radiant smell of roast beef.
"Come on in, come on in," Garrett bellowed. "Diane, they're here."
She came around the corner into the front hall, a small woman in a helmet of permed curls that had been in vogue somewhere around 1983, making a beeline for Jamie, who had just handed his coat to his dad. "There you are," she said, as if he were somehow delinquent, even though he'd obediently answered her summons to dinner and arrived right on time. She pulled Jamie down to her. He was much taller than she was, mirroring his father's height, if not his heft or his looks, and kissed him with a loud, possessive smack, then held his face so he could not look away. She did not look at Fiona yet, and the way she held Jamie's face, he couldn't look at her either. "Your hair is still too long," she said to her son, patting his dark blonde strands. "And this beard, what is this?" She touched it with possessive fingers. "Your father spent 30 years on the force with a haircut and a clean shave." Jamie smiled, waited her out, and straightened when she let him go.
"Mom, you remember Fiona?"
"Yes, of course." Diane tore her gaze from Jamie and turned to Fiona. "Finally! I've made pot roast." Fiona nodded. She could do the girlfriend thing. It just took some practice, that was all. "It smells delicious," she said. Diane gave her a tight smile. "Catch up with your father," she told Jamie. "Dinner is almost ready." Garrett was already handing them each a beer and shepherding them into the living room.
"So here you are," he said, squeezing Fiona's shoulder. "Jamie's mother has been asking for this forever. You two have been together for how long now?"
Jamie shook his head.
"This isn't an interview, Dad." "Of course not. Just never thought I'd see the day I had Malcolm Sheridan's daughter in my living room, that's all."
He said it jovially, with an unmissable undertone of disbelief, and there it was. The history that always pressed down on her, the past that never left. She was with Jamie partly because she never had to talk about it with him, but that was when they were alone. She realized now, standing in this outdated living room, listening to Jamie and his father swap news of the force, that with his family, the history would always be thick. She also realized that she'd known it for the past year, which was why she'd put off coming to dinner. As if to prove it, Garrett swigged his beer and turned to her.
"I hear you were at Idlewild, Fiona. Trespassing. Climbed the fence and everything."
Fiona clutched her untasted beer. "I beg your pardon?"
"Dad," Jamie said.
Garrett laughed.
"You look surprised. I'm good friends with Jack Friesen, who owns the security company they hired out at Idlewild. He told me about the little incident with you."
"I'm writing a story," Fiona managed before Jamie could take up for her again.
"Are you now?"
Garrett asked, and when he looked at her, she saw the face of the man who had testified in court 20 years ago. He'd been younger then, thinner, but his face was the same. He'd been hard then, and he was hard now, beneath the florid, good old boy look.
"That seems like a strange story for you to write."
She shrugged, keeping it light. "Not really."
"I'd think the last place you'd want to be is at Idlewild when they found another body. But I guess I'm wrong."
"Dad," Jamie said again, "enough." They adjourned to dinner, which Diane was serving in the small formal dining room, set with nice china. Outside the window, the Vermont night settled in, and in the darkness, all Fiona could see was their own reflections in the glass.
"I talked to Dave Saunders today,"
Garrett said to her as he put pot roast on his plate.
"He did the autopsy on that body you found."
Jesus, she'd thought he was retired. Retirement obviously meant nothing to Garrett Creel. "What did he say?" she asked him, sipping her beer and watching Diane's face pinch. She likely hated talk like this at the supper table, but with a cop for both a husband and a son, she would have to put up with it in pained silence.
"There isn't much," Garrett said, sawing unconcernedly at his meat. "Died of a blow to the head, almost certainly. Something long, like a baseball bat or a pipe. 2 blows that he can see. Probably 1 to knock her out and 1 to make sure she was dead. No other injuries. She was a teenager, but small for her age. Dead at least 30 years, based on the decomposition. Has been in the well all this time, as far as he can see, since there was no evidence of animals going at her."
Diane made a small sound in her throat that her husband ignored.
"Anything else?"
Jamie asked, spooning potatoes onto his plate. He was as inured to this kind of conversation at dinner as his father was.
"Did he mention any old injuries? Things she might have suffered years before she died?"
"Nope,"
Garrett said.
"Why?"
Jamie glanced at Fiona and said, "We found some evidence that she may have been in a concentration camp during the war." Garrett paused and looked up, surprised. Then he whistled as Diane made another displeased sound.
"Really? When did you learn this?"
"Just before we came here," Jamie said.
"I thought maybe the autopsy would show..." "I'll ask Dave to look again, but he didn't see anything," Garrett said. "Concentration camp. Maybe you'd see broken bones, broken teeth."
He stabbed his fork into a bite of meat.
"She would have been a young girl then. If she was starved, maybe that's why she didn't grow very big. Malnutrition. It's amazing she wasn't gassed."
"Garrett, please," Diane was forced to say.
"Sorry, Mom,"
Jamie said. But he turned back to his father and said, "Her family didn't make it."
"Well, that's a hell of a thing," Garrett said, "to go through all that just to get killed and dropped in a well. Who would kill a girl like that? Sounds like something a Nazi would do. Except she came all the way across the ocean to get away from those bastards."
He shook his head.
"I was always proud that my dad went over there to help us beat those sons of bitches."
"Garrett," Diane said again, and Fiona dropped her gaze to cut her meat. After supper, which felt interminable with tension, Diane busied herself in the kitchen again, cleaning up, and Jamie helped her. Fiona was left alone in the family room with Garrett as a football game played on mute on the TV. She stared at the screen silently, utterly uninterested in football, until she glanced at Garrett and realized he was looking at her. And suddenly, she was finished being polite, just finished. "Listen," she said to Garrett, knowing the words were a bad idea even as she said them. "Jamie isn't in the room. I know you don't want me here. I'll admit, I don't want to be here either. Having dinner with the man who found my sister's body isn't my idea of fun." He blinked at her, momentarily surprised, but there wasn't a shred of sympathy in his expression.
"What you don't understand," he said, "is the influence you have on him. The kind of influence he doesn't need."
It took her a second to follow. "Jamie?" she asked. "You think I have an influence on Jamie?"
"He can't move up if he's dating you," Garrett said. "No one trusts a cop who's in bed with a journalist."
It was probably true, but Jamie had never said anything about it to her. He'd never shown any resentment. He'd also never shown any burning ambition to move up, which was probably what was bothering Garrett. "That's his decision," she said. Garrett shook his head.
"People don't always make the best decisions," he said. "So few people understand that you have to look out for your own best interests, all the time. Sometimes I think Jamie understands that least of all."
She stared at him. This conversation was surreal. Jamie is a good man.
What do you know about it?
He asked softly, and suddenly she knew, in a perfect premonition, that he was about to hurt her, that he was about to hurt her hard.
Tim Christopher was a good man, too, before his life was ruined.
For a second she had no words at all.